over the music. Now start.
Walter Cronkite is just...
Take it away. You do something this year, Don, besides sitting here on your
ass. Well, I've arranged our guest today.
Okay, go ahead. Introduce him.
Go ahead. Start off.
Well, I'd like to introduce a man.
I'll just say why we're here, and this is the first...
Who we are.
Go on, yeah.
Well, we are Michael, John and Don, and Michael and I are riding on John's coattails.
Because it's his show,
It is his show, and I think the introduction was very good. Michael, what did you think about the music?
I'm happy with it, but it's up to him.
I know, I think we'll have a change because it's a new season.
Anyway, what about your intro?
Don, please, off you go.
What about your intro?
Well, we've got our special guest today is a man that I've read his columns with great interest, and his last Saturday one really did resonate with me. His opening paragraph about his auntie taking a horse float and escaping the fires really did touch. And on our left is a man.
On our left.
Well,
this is audio, Guy.
I could be slightly on the left of
this. You better introduce yourself, Andrew.
Just a minute,
yourself.
Andrew. Yeah. Don. This is exactly why I run this show. Keep going, mate. Let's see if you can fuck it up properly before we start. Go on. This is the worst introduction.
Will you come to the rescue? I've obviously done it.
Well, who's on your left, Don?
Andrew Rule.
Very good intro, that.
Thank you very, very much. Good. Thank what you for intro. Coming
it's
along.
It's a pleasure
Andrew.
To be here, gentlemen. I'm a grandfather several times over, including on Boxing Day. But it's great to come here because I feel young.
In case so.
Good point. You've dragged the average age down to 72.
I have.
And in case,
oh, that's good.
In case people haven't quite worked out who Andrew is, he's an award-winning reporter on crime. He has the number one podcast around Australia for his particular category.
Sometimes.
He's been in the media, in the print media. He's been part of the very big series Underbelly. He is well regarded in police circles. And
well regarded.
What?
Well. Bad word, well.
No, it might be the safe word in this
well
instance.
Well regarded.
Mm. Like highly or...
Well, highly regarded, Mick.
Well, let's not argue over a word, boys.
Geez, you were testy.
No, I'll tell you what. And he's come along to give his opinion on various things. I know he's into the climate and I know he's into the horses and animals, but we've got him in today to ask him basically about crime in Victoria or Australia. And I want to ask you first up, Andrew. Do we have faith necessarily in our police force, or are they as nearly corrupt as the people that they're chasing?
Oh, that's a bit tough, Sam.
It's a question.
It is. I think some interstate police forces have had reputations for being corrupt at different times, and I will nominate New South Wales and Queensland, and possibly Perth.
Possibly Perth.
And Victoria has probably looked good by comparison, but it's always good to have an inquiry or a scandal every decade or two, because that sort of it's like burning the undergrowth in the forest. That cleans it up.
Aha. We will get on to that. We can either visit that right now.
No, whatever. No, no, no.
No,
don't
no,
have
but
to.
Well, we will revisit. We'll visit that right now.
Righto.
Revisit that.
Well, why don't we stay with the police, though?
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I take it what you're saying is what we've seen recently in sort of the exposure of people like Simon Overland and others about their deficiencies in office.
Possibly.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's some
of it. There's been some embarrassment. I've always thought the Victorian Police Force was clean by comparison.
By comparison, I think is a fair call.
Okay.
And I'll give you the line that's been used, and it's a good line whether it's right or not, and that is interstate in the old bad old days, unless you were in on the joke, unless you were corrupt, you didn't get to be Chief Commissioner or Assistant Commissioner or Premier, possibly.
Bob Askin.
And you know, in Queensland and New South Wales. And in Victoria, if you're a corrupt copper, you wouldn't get past, you know, Senior Sergeant or Inspector. It was sort of a there was corruption in both, but it wasn't a prerequisite for the top job in Victoria, whereas it sort of was up there, where you had Premiers, you had Neville Rand taking cash money out of illegal casinos. And I know blokes that used to do the drop pay, you know. That's a real thing. That's not just a rumour.
So how are our people like Christine Nixon and Simon Overland and others, how have they fared in recent times?
Badly. Historic history will not portray them very well, particularly Overland in regard to the Lawyer X business. You know, there's probably some... You could make some case for him that he had to work with what he had at the time, but it's not looking great, is it, looking back?
Do you know... sorry, no, boys. Would you know Gobbo?
No, not really. I spoke to her on one occasion, which is relevant here. I was writing a story some years ago about Zara Gard Wilson.
Yes,
the other well known at the time.
colourful.
She had a pet snake in her. I think a carpet python.
She was also into horses. Did you realise that?
Yeah. Yes, she's from Armidale in New South Wales. She's in Western Australia later. Country girl. And kept a snake in her chambers, which fascinated me, and I was able to dub her the hyphen with the python, which I thought was a lot of fun. But I talked to Nicola Gobbo about her because I was writing a piece about Zara Gard Wilson, and I went to the then other female criminal lawyer who was well known, and she said to me, "Oh, that Zara, she's terrible. You know, she's crossed the boundary. She, you know, runs with the enemy. Blah blah blah." On and on, she really slammed her, which was pretty interesting because at the time, she was doing all of those things and more, and makes Zara look like a girl god.
And beside the obvious problem with Lawyer X, is the indirect fallout is that it puts in jeopardy the incarceration of criminals who might have been convicted on corruption or the fact that you can't get a fair trial. That's the problem with the great problem, isn't it?
It is. Let's hope that it doesn't unravel, you know, what have been successful convictions and prosecutions. I suspect in the case of, say, Mockbell, who's the big fish here, that it won't unravel his because he was found guilty on very solid evidence that had nothing to do with her. And in fairness to everyone, you know, if I'm a lawyer and I knock around with crooks, which is what she did, if they're my social friends and they tell me certain things in conversation and I pass them on to the police, that doesn't mean that they've, you know, I'm breaking my ethical considerations to my own clients. Just because she ran around with all these guys and listened to them and relayed what they said, so
she was a bona fide informer. Yeah, yeah.
And that's no one likes informers, and the legal profession is very much up in arms about a lawyer, one of its own, you know, breaching ethics and all that. However, she was still a bona fide informer with a lot of information about a lot of crooks, not necessarily her own clients. It's where they're her own clients and she's compromised them that it gets very murky. And it's where the police should have known better than to lead her on.
Well, they hired her, didn't they?
They did, and they to some extent, I think, exploited someone who was also exploiting them. This is a tricky scenario, and I don't think we can cast her completely as a victim. I suggest that it's a bit like the hooker and the client. Who's committing the crime?
Mm.
When, you know, when some John picks up the streetwalker in wherever of streetwalkers walk, who's committing the biggest crime?
Is she the prostitute or the client?
Mm-hmm. And I think really we've got that problem with this, that she was a willing participant in something that the police should have known better than to exploit as much as they did. And that's where the Overlands of the world and others have overstepped the bounds of common sense and prudence.
Well, I was going to say you something are like that. Extremely allegedly. Well regarded, but I'll say critically regarded and as a critical authority on crime. Why did you decide that this was going to be your vocation? What is your great interest in writing about it all?
Not that I particularly love crime or criminals at all, but I realised early on that writing about things that interested other people was the way to go, and that when I got to the age, 40 years ago, Michael, it is 40 years, 41 years.
Since we met, yeah.
Yeah, yep. 41 years in January. They took one look at me, this sort of rough-head kid from the bush, and they tended to put me in sport and on the courts round and the farming round and police rounds. I was never sent to state rounds or trades hall or any of those things
jobs,
where the
yep.
boring jobs where yep. the future editors were being groomed.
Yep.
And thank God for that, because I got to sort of write about stuff that people were interested in. And I think crime and sport are good things, because you got winners and losers, you got right and wrong, you know, you got heroes and villains. And that's why the Olympics or the footy or the courts are good places to write stuff, so, which is what, you know, Damon Runyon and those guys did.
So the podcast in ranking, the top 12 podcasts in Australia, seven of them are crime kind of related things. Why is there a fascination by society in that, or have you just answered that question?
Well, I think we're all interested in right and wrong and good and evil and life and death. I mean, everybody is, from a very small age. And that all great literature, if you go to, you know, Macbeth or the Greek tragedies, it is always about life and death and essentially about crime. Who, you know, which king killed his brother so he could get the crown or whatever it might be. That these are things that have interested people since we sat around campfires in caves.
What about we call that blue collar crime? What do you think of white collar crime? That doesn't seem to get the exposure that it really should, and those people not brought to justice.
Good point. I think that is a fair point. And yet most of us are probably more likely to be the victim of some form of white collar crime or computer crime or, you know, bank related crime,
yes,
than we are to get mugged in the street. Because, you know, all these scammers plus people that can do stuff with bank accounts and false charities or whatever it might be. There's a lot of it around. And it's billions of dollars around the world.
Is it still as active as what it was, the criminal element in Melbourne?
I think the names just change, and maybe it went from mainstream, the sort of names that a lot of people knew, to perhaps groups, perhaps some ethnic groups where they're not as well known. But where you've got drugs that will make a lot of money, you know, for minimal effort, you'll always have a lot of organised crime, and it doesn't just disappear.
Yeah, Rod Butters, the former St Kilda president,
recently
said of drugs,
yeah,
we should decriminalise them all, but he stopped at the ICE.
Yep.
What did you think about it in the broad principle, and should he have gone all the way and said all drugs should be decriminalised?
Gee, this is where I've told you before I wasn't very bright, and this is where I get tripped up, because I can listen to arguments for both sides of this and find them sort of 70% persuasive either way. And I can see that prohibition doesn't work, and it didn't work in America with alcohol and so on and so forth. And yet, I get that. And it just creates a market, and the market creates criminality, mm-hmm. you know. So, and yet I can listen to the other side and say you just throw it open and it's still killing kids.
Well, Sammy, on that point, recently I was having a drink with people who've got kids who went to the Falls concert, right?
Yes.
And they were telling me about different ways about how they smuggle alcohol and drugs in there. And the view from someone who you would believe should know said that 70% of the kids going to that concert,
yes,
had or would acquire drugs,
yes,
on the night, right?
Yep, that'd be right.
Now, why wouldn't we decriminalise it and make sure that the products they were taking,
yes,
were that the quality was okay and wasn't going to kill them? Isn't that a reasonable argument?
I'm only being the devil's advocate, but I presume we're paying lip service to just letting people just go on benders and make a wreck of their lives and kill themselves on drugs if it's not policed. I presume that's why you don't do it. But as Andrew says, you might not have said this, but the huge part of criminality in this society today is the supply and demand for drugs and the importation and manufacture of them, and it seems to run the criminal world.
So if it were done properly, Andrew,
yeah,
if there were quality controls and the distribution was orderly, would that not remove the criminal element?
would help, you'd think, control it. But does that make it less of a social evil? I mean, I don't think it does. But the drugs,
but the social
are,
evil exists,
drugs are addictive and destructive.
Yeah.
And they do your brain in or do your nerves in or whatever it might be. So that you're not actually cleaning them up enough to make them harmless.
So they've started in the States, haven't they, by most of the states legalising marijuana. I know they get away with it on the medicinal marijuana, but you can now go and buy marijuana in domestic quantities for your own personal use in most states in America. So okay, they're just dipping a toe in the water. In fact, they've thrown their hands in the air.
That's true. And look, prohibition's interesting, isn't it? We had prohibition in America. We say it didn't work. Okay, it created great mobs of gangsters that we still talk about, etc. However, let's go further back in history to Hogarth's London, you know, Georgian England. The government couldn't get brandy out of France because they were fighting with the French. And they said they passed laws to make gin out of corn. The corn, they had these sort of corn laws.
Potatoes,
make gin and potato, whatever, corn and potatoes. And so gin production increased and they made it cheap. And for about five decades, the whole underclass of England was just wrecked by gin. There were babies left to die. There were people burnt in fires. There was murders committed. It was awful. And it's a bit like the ice epidemic now. And, you know, those Hogarth pictures, you've seen them. You know, the woman throwing the baby out the window and all that stuff. It's all was all real. It happened. And it was the gin thing. And over decades, the government started to clamp down on gin production and make it illegal to sell it and so on and so on. So that's an example of, you know, making the laws very liberal. They actually fueled their own fire and created a noose around the neck of society.
And that's the point, isn't it? So it's all right for Rod Butters, who at the drop of a hat could take a gram of coke in through his hooter at most meetings that he attended
possibly
at the
did.
AFL. No, he did. That's a fact, and he knows that, and he's that's well documented. But it's all right to say that, but then if your granddaughter, Mick, grows up to be a 16, 17 or 18-year-old member of society and just decides that she wants to buy some coke or get some heroin or just get some drugs at the local apothecary or a drugstore, no pun intended, or the chemist, I mean, where does that start and end? I mean, honestly and truly.
But our kids, we've all got
might
kids.
Might be self-regulatory in the end.
But
perhaps.
Our kids, I get the impression from our offspring that they can get drugs as often
they can, Michael,
as they want.
And people not on them are a rarity. Young people that are not on them are a rarity.
If you've got three kids, two of them will have been will have been using drugs.
So why don't we supervise the quality then? And take the markup out.
Because you just hope that you brought your kids up a little bit better than that, Michael.
That's a good point, Mick. Supervise the quality and then what? Sell it at, instead of having a pie stand at the football, sell it at a drug stand. No, I'm not being...
It gets tricky.
So you supervise the quality, say, ecstasy tablets are absolutely pure, will not do you any harm except give you a nice kick for a day and a half, three more sleeps till Christmas, or the cocaine that we've got here is pretty pure. So go and where do you have shops that specialise in selling drugs? Where how do you make that work?
No,
has
I don't
anyone
know the
thought
answer
of that?
To it. I'm
neither
a bit
do
with,
I.
With Andrew, I think that you could hear arguments for both sides and be almost persuaded.
Yep.
But then you don't realise the inherent problems.
And I have seen some commentators, Michael, without naming names, who have sort of switched over time from one, veered from one side of the argument to the other, you know.
Like who?
Oh, no.
No, but
they're commentators, they've
published
it. No,
but what does that mean? You mean because they are recidivist users or users?
I'll just say people, I think we can't form a firm opinion that sticks. It's like, you know.
Like capital punishment.
People
say we shouldn't, and then someone says there are that many heinous crimes that we actually should get rid of people who have lost their right to live on this planet, and we should actually have capital punishment.
Whole other bag
that's
of
right,
cats. Yeah. And that's one where you could run parallel arguments and sort of persuade somebody as gullible as me either way. But I will say about capital punishment that my friend and mentor Les Carline, who did have a brain, he said to me once, and he was a deeply conservative man and not overly sentimental. He said he was against capital punishment, not because he wanted to, you know, save lives, but he said in the end, everybody that gets put to death, he said he's put to death for a political reason rather than the crime. Ultimately, Ryan hanged because Bolte wanted to hang somebody to win an election. He wanted to hang a very, very bad fella, a bloke who killed a clergyman's mother, a 90-year-old woman or something, a shocking fella called Tate.
Yes.
And he didn't get to hang him, and he got to hang Ryan. Now, in 1966, there were the Shepparton murders of Medill and Haywood, which you will all recall. Yeah, and I wrote the book about this many years later. And the boyfriend of the dead girl, Medill, was accused by the then fairly corrupt police of doing it. And they belted him and they belted him and they belted him and they tortured him for week after week after week. And that kid was too smart and too tough to sign a bit of paper so they'd stop belting him. Now, had he signed up and said, "Stop hitting me, I'll sign your bit of paper," he probably would have swung, because Bolte would have been immensely popular. Decision.
Yes.
Bolte would have hanged him, won the election instead of Ryan. This is right in 1966, seven. Perfect time. And he didn't do it. Raymond Edmonds did it.
And absolutely absolutely correct. Yep. But when it is, and Bolte, I agree with you about the political decision with Ryan, we were all around then. But when it is an absolute foregone conclusion, where there is absolutely no doubt,
Gargasoulis.
Gargasoulis. Yes, and Gary Stinky, what's his name?
Mr. Stinky. you could make quite a list of
Ivan Milat.
A list of people that would be get in the top 10 or 12, yeah.
Julian Knight.
The bigger bloke, Camilleri.
So when it is an absolute no-brainer,
my point
about it is, and we've said this before, is I take exception to my taxes keeping those people alive when they have given up their right to be on the planet, because they are just pieces of crud.
They are. That is true. And, you know, when they...
And there's no chance of rehabilitation.
No. But keeping them miserable in jail's not a bad alternative either. Mm. It's not a great life.
Sammy, just on that, how did you feel retrospectively about the two kids that were executed in Bali on the drug charges? And on what I read, they were changed people when they were in custody.
Yes. Yeah, it didn't make me feel particularly good.
But they went
over there knowing.
They weren't great. Yeah, it's dead right.
They knew exactly what they were getting
committed
into.
But on the question of rehabilitation, it would seem that those two were on the path, were they not?
Probably so, and I don't know what. Yeah, in the end, and I'm not an anti-hanger really, it was interesting to hear Les reckon, and he made a point. And in America, you know, people basically on death row, the statistics swing very heavily one way. So it's in certain states, and it's certain people of certain ethnic origin that are getting the chop. It won't be Harvey Weinstein.
Now listen, can we change the subject and do a complete swing around, because this man's got many facets. I would like to know whether your auntie got those ponies out and what happened to them in that bushfire that went through now.
There's been a respite there.
But the ponies.
The pony. Well, she got some stock out and then she had some unbroken young stock she just turned them loose and opened all the gates. And there's enough bare paddocks. I don't think it was an issue. Even if the fire went through there, which it didn't in the end, but it still could, I think they're okay, because there's water, you know, there's a lake and there's bare paddocks with no trees in it. So they'd be okay, but she just made it open. They were too sort of hard to catch and handle, you know.
And get them away, and I can understand.
So, she got away the older stock that was broken in. But that fire, it could just fire up again on Thursday or Friday. And, you know, while the bush around her remains unburnt, it'll be a powder keg and could
So why go is up. The country on fire?
Well, look, there's no dead easy answer to this. And it's I think I've already been slightly pilloried by some people as promoting a sort of a simplistic fix, and that is burning off. I realise the problem. The problem, we have got a changing climate. Now, I hope it's a man-made thing. I hope it's carbon, because we have a chance to reverse that. If it's not carbon and it's not man-made, we're in deep trouble, because it's coming from, you know, the universe.
Yeah, but we had a fire back in 1939 when none of us were around, exactly. Which is far more catastrophic than what this one is now.
Very bad. And in 1851, there was a quarter of Victoria burnt in 1851.
And those fires in 1939, the days preceding were around 40 to 45 degrees.
Very similar.
And a northerly wind blowing. Very similar. It affected three quarters of Victoria.
It's wrong to think that something that's happening to us now has never happened before. That's true.
But Sam always gets into me about this, but the weight of evidence from...
You're the token lefty, aren't you?
Well, yeah.
He is.
He'd agree with that. The weight of evidence from the scientific...
Nothing wrong with that.
From the scientific community is overwhelming. Overwhelming.
Yeah, but that... And fair enough. And I don't want to get into that argument, because it's like... But
that is the argument.
Well, hang on. No, fuel reduction and trying to stop houses burning down and so on is a bit like a reactive thing. When a bloke's trying to break in here with a baseball bat and get our car keys, it's no point us picking up an essay about the causes of crime and poverty and waving it at him. It's not going to work. We can believe that poverty causes crime and believe that we need more schools and we need rehabilitation and all that good stuff. But when the bloke's coming for you with a baseball bat, you actually need a strategy or a tactic to cope with the baseball bat. Regardless of the big global causes of warm weather and hot winds and all that, and therefore fires, we actually need tactics to counter the effects of it, and that is we need to have... burn-offs, we need fire breaks, we need this, we need this, we need this. We need all sorts of things. More than we ever did.
I accept that, but I'm talking about the long-term.
Long-term, yeah.
Long-term view.
You're talking about the essay about crime, in a sense.
We've got to look further than 2020.
Absolutely right.
And do what, Mick?
Well, with regard to climate.
And do what?
Yes, I understand, but what are we talking about? Bushfires or climate
change? And try to minimise climate change, because... the scientists will tell us to a man that the problems in the world are caused by climate change.
And China and India would be about 70% of that or whatever. And unless you nuke them, they're going to keep doing it. So it's all very well talking about, you know, Scott Morrison should sign a piece of paper as if that's going to stop bushfires. It's really nonsensical to think that any Australian or Canadian or Finnish politicians can sign a few things and go for the group picture and smile for the camera and think it's going to actually do anything.
But we can't abandon that.
We can't.
We've got to be mindful of that rather than just say, India and China won't change, therefore we'll just keep doing what we're doing.
But it's a real... No, that's true. But it's a real thing that no matter what action people... take in this country and countries like us, it's not actually just going to change the climate.
And unfortunately,
that's our problem.
Unfortunately, it's a bit like your analogy with Henry Bolte. It just, in the end, this climate debate and global warming gets politicised.
Everything does.
Both camps.
And you find yourself on sort of shoved on a bus that you don't want to be on. I mean, if you write or do a podcast about... farmers should be allowed to have better guns so they can put down their 22,000 burnt sheep. Next thing, you'll get 500 letters and emails and texts from lunatic gun nuts that you don't want to talk to, but you can't help ending up in the bus with people that you don't want to talk to. It's very tricky, all this stuff, because you get support from people that you don't really want to be associated with.
But you only make it tricky yourself, don't you? You should be far more simplistic in your view. Then it wouldn't become tricky.
But these issues aren't simple.
Well, they aren't simple.
Well, you make them difficult, but they are.
I do.
Well, I mean, we talk about this well, you wrote in your article about controlled burning.
Yeah.
Why can't that be done? I mean, you cited...
Because it becomes political, Donald. No, it doesn't. Because the Greens say you cannot burn any undergrowth.
I can finish, John, you mentioned about the Noongar people in Western Australia. Yep. Also up in New South Wales, the fires that had just gone through, the Aboriginals who... burnt around, I think it was ritual type burning.
Yep.
He left, and it was on a number of properties. They left their property. Coming back, they thought their houses would be burnt. Nothing left. They were still there when they got back because they'd cleared
around
the undergrowth. Now, that's simplistic.
Right. Oh, yeah, it's a simple precaution and often would work and does work. But I concede it's not that easy. You know, John Thwaites was on the radio this morning saying that in 2005 he was the Environment Minister or whatever he was, and they did a fuel reduction burn at Wilson's Prom, and it got away and it burnt, you know, all of Wilson's Prom and some houses or whatever. And so he realised then that it was tricky. It was hard to once you light a fire, I tell you what, nobody says this, but without doubt, litigiousness is an issue. If it's all right, we can sit here because we haven't actually got to make these decisions. So we can pontificate all day and then go and have a cup of tea, and that's fine. But if you're the Premier, or if you're the Emergency Minister, or if you're the Chief Bureaucrat or the Chief Fire Bloke, you have to sign a bit of paper to say, yes, go and set fire to the woods.
Mm.
And when that fire gets away and becomes a bigger scandal than Lawyer X, it's on your head. No matter what they say, they'll blame you for it.
Because the fires get away.
And you'll do your career cold. But if lightning starts it or an arsonist starts it and it burns down 10 times the number of houses, not my fault.
No, but it's a natural event, isn't it?
But that's the thing.
Arsonist.
If I'm the chief bureaucrat that's got to sign the paper, I'd rather... that lightning started it,
sure.
Not me.
Yes, because
before the bureaucrats got involved, how many of these fires actually got out of control in the high country and around Victoria? Because I grew up in Box Hill and we used to go out, or my parents did, burn the vacant blocks. Or everybody permission.
Everybody did it
to get rid of snakes and whatever else.
Old-timers always did.
And the fires never got away.
That's true. People used to burn off leaves, the suburban people, country.
Well, I've got blackberries on my place now. Do I use poison? I'd rather burn, but I'm not allowed.
You probably ought to use goats and then burn.
Hey, Andrew, are you fearful for the future of newspapers?
Oh, yeah. I think we're let's be careful about this. But there's still readers, Mick. There's still readers. There's plenty of eyeballs. But it's the advertising model that got shattered, you know, in the 90s, I would suggest, by the coming of the internet and the short-sightedness of those proprietors at the time who didn't sort of buy into, you know, they were horse and buggy people who said these cars won't, these Model T Fords, they won't last, and they sort of ignored it. They said, we'll just put rubber tyres and brakes on our horses and buggies. Is what they didn't really grasp it and get into the online ads and so on. And so they missed the boat, and that meant the rivers of gold went to other people's pockets, and that meant newspapers have sort of starved for funds.
Well, in 1979, you talked about it before when we first met, I went from The Age to The Old Herald.
You did, right? I remember. Yeah, Ronnie Carter used to call you Elf after Alf Brown.
That's right. Well, I followed Alf Brown.
Yeah.
1979, The Herald and The Sun were different papers. They're now combined.
Yeah.
Different papers. Sammy, you listen to this? They were pumping out 1.1 million copies a day from 44...
I'm sorry, what did you say then?
Are you listening?
What do you mean am I listening to it?
You're doing your nails.
I wasn't. I was looking down at something on my finger.
So the Herald and Weekly Times was pumping out 1.1 million copies a day from 44 Flinders Street, and The Age was selling, I think, about 400.
Yep, and a lot of ads in that on the Saturday. Yeah.
Now, my guess now is the Herald and Sun are combined and are selling probably 300 and something a day.
I'm not dead sure, but you may well be
right. And I think The Age is about 90,000 a day.
Probably, if it's lucky.
So, So there's 390,000.
But there's online eyeballs. There's people watching, looking at it online. Yeah,
but I'm worried about, I'm a person that likes to feel the paper and read my stories.
I've got them here.
In print. So do you think that they're doomed, or do you think that they can survive on a lower base?
It looks as if, against predictions, they are surviving. And it's interesting to see Nine come into Fairfax and hire journalists and good journalists and good young people and keep it going. And I think that's a good sign that maybe we've hit a sort of a plateau.
Yes.
Like with book publishing. Now, book publishing isn't what it used to be, but it's still there. And it plateaued. You know, it plummeted, but it's sort of bottomed out.
So here's a quick survey of just – of the five people in this room. Well, Jack's – I haven't canvassed.
She's a person.
Oh.
Yeah. I haven't canvassed Jack. Of the five people in this room, four of them, Mr. Rule, Mr. Scott, Mr. Sheehan and Mr. Newman, would still prefer to read their news out of something they can hang on to and flick through and turn the pages over. And a man sitting over to in front of me, who I can't mention his name, Rod Law, he says he doesn't think that papers have a future. I think you'd rather read them on the internet.
No, so they do have a future. It's just the
actual...
Yeah.
That's all right. That's
true.
Well, this is ridiculous. I think Rod's right.
Well, he said he still reads both papers every day, so five but people would rather read the paper.
But we're fossils.
We relics.
We are fossils.
We are, yes. And he's 30 years younger than us.
That's right.
There's the answer.
So we're waiting for the youth. We're waiting for the youth of Australia to grow into our age, who have known nothing more than reading it off a tablet.
Yep.
And true. Papers will be gone.
They will
well,
be.
Well, that's what. Hence the question.
Except as a sort of a, they might survive in some small
truck,
you know, specialist form.
What's your favourite form of expression? You're a podcaster, whatever they are. You're a person who does podcast. Yeah, you're on radio and you're a print journal. What's your favourite medium
for the hardest work is writing well. I think it's hard to write well. It's hard for me to write well. Because it's hard
falsely
work.
Falsely humble
person. It's very hard work. I find the other stuff more spontaneous. You know, doing this, I regard as, it's not that taxing compared with trying to write 1,000 words that's flawless.
Are we serious about the police tackling crime? They don't carry guns, not allowed to use them. They don't chase people in cars when they have people abscond. We don't pay lip service to controlling the bikies rather than having SAS squads go and completely stop bikies from doing what they do.
I reckon you might be overstating the...
I might be.
A bit. I think they do carry guns and they do use them a bit, and they do use the SOG, you know, those sort of blokes to crack open the bikies at different times. They've knocked over bikie clubhouses with heavy machinery. You know, they do some tricky, interesting... things. I think they do a pretty good job. They're not flawless, and you know, it's a bureaucratic organisation, and it's like all those things, and they're hampered. You know what? One of the problems these days.
The most careful answer I've ever heard.
Now, one of the problems is everyone's walking around with a thing called a camera now in their phone.
Absolutely.
And so nothing that happens is going to go unrecorded.
Spot on.
Which is why, you know, you and I aren't going to get out of our cars and punch an old lady in the throat because she scratched our car.
Oh, he might.
Someone is going to film us. And 25 years ago, you know, all sorts of atrocities happened.
Ever been threatened by someone you've written about?
I've had the odd threat, but the threats have come from people that probably weren't really a danger. You know, I've had a car damage at home. I've had a brick put in my letterbox by a bloke that was in jail, sent somebody. I've had another car damaged badly.
What's a brick in the letterbox?
I know where you live. We know where you live. It was a rented house at the time where I hadn't been long. It was good
work.
Do you
have any friends that are... Have you ever befriended any criminals for any reason?
Yeah, John Sylvester and I published all the Chopper Reed stuff, and we knew him very well, and others, you know, scallywags that you meet.
And so your sources of information are both from criminals and police.
Yeah, a bit. I'm not a massive. I don't break. You know,
no, he's more
big crime stories. I write stuff.
Yeah.
You know, at our paper, the Herald Sun, we've got a marvellous police reporter, crime writer, and that's Mark Butler. And he breaks stories. Anthony Dowsley, they break stories. People like myself and Patrick Carline, we tend to write stories, which is a different, you know, one's a bowler and one's a batsman.
What's your passion in life?
Reading, funnily enough, more than writing. I'm interested in racing. I'm not a big punter and I'm not a keen punter.
You were a jockey.
I rode as a kid, I rode in a few picnic races, which is
what,
hardly
on like, horses or ponies?
I rode on horses and I rode ponies, but I rode at registered picnic meetings, you know, like up in Gippsland.
Was Jay Rule the jockey related
my
to
my cousin,
you?
First cousin, the late JD Rule,
yeah.
And a very good jockey. He was a contemporary of Paul Jarman.
Yes.
They were mates and...
What's the best horse Jarman rode?
You tell me. I don't know.
Caraman.
Yeah, and John rode as well as him as a kid.
You impressed with that, John?
Yes, yeah, Mick, and I'm not looking at you, but I was listening.
yeah. Caraman, is that right? Yeah.
Hey, before I forget it... You can come back. Just staying with the criminal element.
Yeah, right.
Dustin Martin's father...
Speaking of racing.
Martin's father's not allowed in Australia.
Yeah.
Right, he was deported, which you've got to be very bad to get deported. I still haven't read or heard why Shane Martin is not allowed to live in Australia, other than the fact that I know he's a bikie.
Well, if you're, it must breach a actual law, and that'll be, you know, criminal gatherings, groups, blah blah blah. You know,
get deported for that. You can be a pedophile and not be deported.
Well. If you're a member of some of those outlaw motorcycle gangs, as defined under Act whatever, can't have a gun license and you can't do this and you can't do that. And if you're born somewhere else and they decide you're a bad guy, they can send you back to where you come
somewhere
from.
Else, they can deport.
No. There's an Irish priest who was found guilty and they wanted to deport him and he appealed and he stayed here. Oh, there's something.
The Irish have a lot of. They've got a lot of influence,
and we would have thought they should have. But in that case, no. But Shane, I reckon you know the answer to this. Right. I reckon you know what Shane Martin has done.
No, hand on heart, but it'll breach. You know, some technical.
Being a bikie.
Yeah, you know, outlaw motorcycle gangs. There's legislation about them.
Yeah, but Mick,
organised crime.
We've had this discussion before. If you are a felon or break a law here, you can't go into the United States if you are a convicted.
No,
that's
right.
What I said about Bill Clinton, who broke a law by perjury and got impeached for lying, and they want to come out here to the President's Cup. Why would they let him into the country? He's a felon.
Well, that's still. I still think that there's something hidden and we don't know about Shane.
Okay, if there is, I don't know it.
Well, so a lot of bikies should be deported then. If you get
if they're born somewhere else and haven't got an Australian passport, that would be that probably. Oh, and they have been. There's one sent back to Malta. Yeah, that has happened. Yeah, that's right. Just not as well. They just don't happen to have sons who are champion footballers.
Okay. I thought your passion when I asked you this question might have been about horses because in an article you wrote a couple of weeks ago, went to great detail on how your racehorse was rehoused and became a polo pony.
It's a story. 4 years ago, my first grandchild was born and he was lucky to survive and he was spent 13 weeks in intensive care at the Children's Hospital, which is a great place, and they saved him. And I was very we were all of us, my wife and I, and obviously the child's parents, my son and his wife, were very upset and worried and anguished. And I bought a filly by Wanted out of Untainted. And I bought her mainly because of I like the look of her, but I mainly bought her because of her pedigree, because we called her Answered Prayers because the little boy had survived. And we put together a syndicate of friends and syndicated this filly. And she went on to be... not the best racehorse, but when she was broken in, she was a little neat, sort of nippy thing. I liked the way she walked and all that. She had a good attitude. When she was broken in, I paid the bloke down at Barwon Heads, actually, the broker, good broker, used to work for Snowden's, and Brad Pearson's his name. I paid him extra to keep her for more time to make a good job of her. I said, if, you know, I don't want something bad to happen to this filly. If she's not a good racehorse, which most of them aren't, particularly little cheap ones, and you know, most of them aren't, but that's a fact. I wanted to have a chance in life, so do extra with her. And she was pretty good to ride and all that. And he did. And sure enough, she had, you know, eight starts or whatever, and she never got closer than... She nearly ran third one day by about an inch. And we sent it to the polo people.
Because she was better, and, a little bit better educated.
And she was small and neat and nippy and hadn't really been wrecked. She hadn't been spoilt. She'd been handled by Catherine Durden, trained her at Moriac, and her husband Craig, and they're very good horse people and they look after them well and they don't knock them about and make them pull and all that. So she has become a crackerjack novice polo pony on the way to being a crackerjack made polo pony. Ridden by a professional who says he thinks he's worth taking to England to play in the big league at some stage.
In the paper on Saturday, just going on a little bit further, I don't know if you saw the ad, yeah, but it was taken out by Racing Victoria.
Yep.
What did you think of the ad?
I thought it was good for newspapers.
That's what about the ad? Explain what the ad was, saying people like me had never heard of it.
Well, if you'd done your research, you would have known about it. On ads and the racing? No, it was a whole page taken out by Racing Victoria, yes, about the rehousing of, yep, racehorses or thoroughbreds.
Yep.
And I thought it was, I thought there was a lot of, excuse the expression, a lot of shit in it.
Well, they're fighting a public relations battle.
Exactly. That
and
was a public relations.
They're doing the soft and cuddly stuff. And you can't blame them for that. And pictures of mares and foals and nice words, it's what public relations is. You can see it. You're a horseman and you're a wise old head. And you can see that there's an element of PR fluff in that. That doesn't mean they shouldn't do it. The reality with racing is there will be a wastage. And if our filly hadn't been, you know, handy on her feet and good to ride, she, and if she'd been, say, dangerous, if she'd been a kicker or a rearer or a striker, and I have had horses like that in the past, as you have, you wouldn't want to pass them on to somebody as a hack. Particularly to a child.
Why flower the whole issue up? There are 14,000 horses bred.
Yep.
And one of their point or their key, yep, points is...
In the ad, Don, that no one read.
In the ad.
A lot of people read it.
Euthanasia.
I haven't got to read the ads in the paper yet. I'm just reading the news at this stage.
About euthanasia. Yeah. We all know that that's, yeah, going to happen. The other side about retraining, throwing $25 million, $8 million, yeah, a year. Where does $8 million go with regard to rehousing?
You cannot rehouse that many horses every year,
exactly,
because horses live for you know, for 20 years and they'll be useful for 19 of those years, some of them, and that you just can't rehouse them all, so some of them will not be rehoused, and in the end you have to make a decision about, you know, does it, they won't, don't just die in an old people's home with whale music going, at some point they have to be put down, whether they're 29 or 19 or 9 or 6. They will have to be put down in some way. It's the manner in which they're put down that is the issue, I believe. And I think there's a lot of room for the industry to ensure that there are mobile people available who are really good at what they do, who go to properties and euthanise horses in a really humane way and do it well, do it properly, do it nicely, so they're not being shoved onto trucks, sent to Echuca across the state and then up to Queensland to be killed. The trip alone is tough on animals. That trip alone.
They're done in Shepparton too.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, yeah. But that's right.
What, so, they put down in Shepparton?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and right. Knackery. Mm. Knackeries
aren't. Can you read the
Knackeries
ad?
Are around.
They're not great.
In the
they're
ad.
Not great things. But everybody's walking a dog around. Everybody's walking a dog or got a cat at home.
That's right.
And most of us have. Most of us have. We're not feeding them on pumpkins.
That's right.
They eat meat. And the meat comes from knackeries and abattoirs.
We had two people on, David Hayes and Amanda Elliot,
yeah,
and you obviously you've grown up with horses. You know, what do you think about racing 2 year olds?
Oh. Not mad about it. Don't love
what
it.
What about and the ring bit in their mouth?
I think
just because you're ignorant and don't know.
I think it'd be better if horses only had an educational run as a late two-year-old in a perfect world, and then did more racing as three-year-olds, and that's the policy we follow with our – not that I'm a – I mean, I'm involved in two or three cheap horses.
No, but you've grown up with horses. You know what – you break them in as three-year-olds.
And you know that – you and I know that a horse is not really well-developed till they're five. And a horse, I wrote the Winx book, and Winx kept growing and getting heavier, and I reckon, until she was seven.
Did you – you did Gerard Whateley wrote a book about Winx, too.
He wrote
Black Caviar.
Black Caviar.
Yeah, yeah.
A very fine book.
Which
– we complement each other's books. Yeah, yeah. That's what we stick together.
They ran over different distances. Who do you think has been – had the better career?
Look, you know, it's, you can compare on the greatest middleweight, the greatest heavyweight. I mean, is Sugar Ray Leonard really inferior to – I mean, it's tricky, isn't it?
Mm.
I look, Marvelous Black Marvelous. Caviar was never – never she was never beaten, and that's a wonderful thing. Mind you, there was a mare in the 1870s in Europe that did 54 starts and never beaten. So never being beaten – of itself, it's great and it's wonderful and Guinness Book of Records stuff. When it comes to absolute quality, I don't know. No, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, Winx was better at middle distances where, and therefore it was more of a chance to take on the world.
The Group Ones
had they decided to
sway
it
in Winx's favour, I reckon.
They're all recent. Yeah. They're all recent history. Yeah. But if you go back, there were good racehorses in years gone.
Brilliant.
Tullock. Kingston Town.
Oh, Rising Fast, Gadam, Gay Poss, Prince Jandika.
Gay
They're off!
Poss.
Oh, good Gay even, bro.
You know who Couldn't Gay Poss me. Is?
No, I've got no idea.
Hey, where did that come from?
He knows
all that stuff.
Now, that was very impressive.
Yeah. His book, his Andrew Rule's book, would be far superior to, not necessarily, Gerard Whateley's.
No.
I'm giving you a backhanded compliment here, mate. He's a Gold Walkley Award winner for his book on power and rape.
Is that right?
That was the Jeff Clark story that he's referring to.
Oh, yeah.
Is that what that is, power and rape?
Yeah, it was a story about the head of ATSIC back in early in this century.
Did you report on that as a journo
at
the paper?
At
did
the
you
break that was. That
you
was
break the story.
I did. Yeah, it was a very big story at the time.
Huge story. That huge was story huge.
And you wrote a bio on Kerry Stokes
because you
thought he'd been maligned?
I don't know. I didn't
think you didn't?
Any such thing. But I was approached to write. He decided when a book was being written about him that it was his story and he didn't want somebody pinching his story. This is the mindset of, you know, those sort of competitive people, Sam.
Yep.
And he said, right, let's find a really good writer to write a really good book. And I was approached and I suggested various other people, to tell you the truth.
Who wanted you?
Well, in the end, they said, in the end, I agreed to do it. And it was good and I'm pleased I did.
Yes, because so he wanted
I got to talk to an interesting... And I got sort of the inside story on a very interesting Australian.
Yes.
He wanted
the accurate story on his life, not some...
Look, they're funny, those...
Convoluted stories.
I wasn't against it. The other story was written by a former colleague of mine, Margaret Simons, and although she bagged me a little bit for writing the authorised biography, I won't bag hers because I thought it was a pretty good effort. And I said that to the Stokes family. I said, she's a good journalist. She's fair. She's accurate. You know, she's not the devil.
Did she go
after
him?
And I actually defended her to them.
Did she go after him?
Not overly. I mean, there's certain reasons for that too. Like defamation, and you wouldn't be defaming a billionaire.
Talking about that, now, you wrote an obituary 3 weeks ago, I reckon, within the last month, about the late Bill Waterhouse.
Oh, yeah.
That was
good.
That was the most... I sent you a note about that.
Yeah.
It was the most scathing assessment of an individual living or dead that I've read.
And no one... Although I got two lawyers' letters over it, which were very humorous, no one disputed the facts.
Now, I want to ask you this, though.
I can go with this. This is quite good.
Devil's advocate.
Yeah.
If you knew all that stuff about Bill Waterhouse,
mm-hmm.
why did you not write it while he was alive?
Mickey, I've spent a lot of time in courts being sued and I would not have a mortgage. I would not have a mortgage today had I not been sued over Waterhouse stuff I've written in the past. So don't be saying I didn't have the ticket.
No, because I did.
No, I know. But I'm telling you something you don't know, and that is I have been sued by Waterhouse and those in their employ and patsies for them. Because I have written tough stuff about Waterhouse for 25 years.
Andrew.
And you shouldn't have drawn that conclusion because I didn't say
that. No, I'm just saying.
But I'm saying to you, why couldn't – does the law not allow Robbie Waterhouse or Gay Waterhouse to sue?
No.
They can't
sue. Can I tell you about the
funeral? You can't get sued for writing about someone who's dead.
That's dead right. Can I tell you about –
excuse the pun.
That's dead right. And that's why I wrote it, because he's dead. I was waiting for him to die.
Yeah, you just smashed him, didn't you?
I did, and I gave Neville Wran a touch up when he died too. You should look that one up.
Well, look those up because I'd be interested in reading.
Oh, I think
Waterhouse
should.
Accused Waterhouse. This is how I read it. You accused Waterhouse of being a race rigger over the Big Falloon Melbourne Cup. Yeah. And did you accuse him of murder?
Well, George Brown's death he had his arms twisted out of their sockets and both legs broken.
So that's close to murder.
And killed and burnt.
Okay, so I'll take that as murder. Yeah. You accuse him of being a draft dodger?
He didn't go. I don't know if they had the draft, but he did not go. That's the true. Yeah, I did indeed. Yeah, he changed courses at university. His son told me this. He changed from law to medicine for a year or two, and then back to law when the war ended.
So, geez, it was fear. I can't remember anything fierce.
No one denied. Now, can I tell you the wash-up of this?
Yeah.
Bill Waterhouse's funeral was meant to be a very big affair, and they were meant to have the big wake at the Randwick Racecourse, which is a very big place, and you could fit a lot of people there. Well, after that story went around, they decided to not do Randwick, or somebody decided Randwick was off the menu, and they had it at the Kirribilli Yacht Club, which is about as big as this room.
Is that right?
And you know how many people went? About 350, and 200 of them were Tongans, because Bill had
he was the envoy or something.
He went to uni with the Tongan king.
Wow.
They used to do a bit of business together, Don, such as growing dope in Tonga and selling Tongan passports out the back door, Michael. And that's why there were 200 Tongans. And you know who broke George Brown's, the trainer's legs, and then killed him and then burnt him? Tongans.
Did they?
Working for the Waterhouses. Well, working, let's say in this instance, for Bill.
For Bill.
We won't be saying other Waterhouses because Robbie would be highly
Robbie's still with us.
Oh, yes.
No need to mention Robbie in this.
What is his son?
Did you listen?
No, he's not mentioning Robbie, and you didn't mention Robbie, and that's nothing to do with it. And the only reason I know you can't be sued for writing about someone who's dead is Darren Hinch, if you'll remember, had a theory about why Graham Kennedy died.
Yep.
Said he had AIDS.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And he said that after made a nice popular person of himself with Graham's friends. But that's what Darren said, and I know that's why you can't sue someone when they're dead, or vice versa.
You can't sue over it. Yeah.
Yes,
and look, it's sad. See, if somebody slashed your parents, you say you die tomorrow, and everybody kicks you to death afterwards, so to speak, trashes your reputation. It would make your children very sad that they couldn't take some legal recourse.
Yes.
And I get that.
Yeah,
it's tough. Just on the funeral though. I understand that Malcolm Turnbull was approached about speaking at the funeral, and after that story came out, he said allegedly to Bill Waterhouse's trainer daughter-in-law, he said, not only I won't be speaking giving a eulogy at the funeral, I won't be attending, and if I were you, I wouldn't go either, he said to her, and guess what? She didn't go. She did not attend Bill's funeral.
You're an interesting character, a boy from Nowra.
Now and now.
Have you evolved over the years? You started at the Gippsland, Star or Tribune? Or
the Times. Gippsland Times and the Mafra Spectator.
I think he's evolved, Donald.
Have you evolved or you are natural?
I've learned.
Were you like this when you were writing down in Gippsland?
No, I was a kid. And I worked, I worked with a lot of very
some
fine
of these characteristics.
A lot of fine journalists, and I was lucky enough to work cheek by jowl with people like Mick and a lot of others And I learnt from them by watching what they did and listening to their criticisms. And there was, yeah, you know, an age sport, for instance. Okay. There was a group of people there, when you look back on it, who were very good at what they did.
Slattery, Grant.
Yeah, all that, they, were all, yeah. they were all good at it. They were all good at
Jennifer
something.
Jennifer Byrne was there, wasn't she?
She was. Yeah. Terrific.
In the sports department, Ron Carter. Ron, yeah. Peter McFarlane there then?
He was.
Yeah.
I was very friendly with him.
Yeah.
He had his faults, but he was a good teacher.
Glenn Lester.
Beautiful writer.
Tony Burke.
Tony
what
the
constitutes
King?
A beautiful writer for you guys? Just fill us in
this
on.
This is in the... Yeah. Go on.
A beautiful writer.
Yes.
Somebody who can capture emotions, either funny humour or sadness. I think really somebody who can draw
so
an emotional response.
Between a writer and a reporter and a writer.
Yeah, the reporters break stories. Ronnie Carter was a classic news-breaking reporter, wasn't he?
Yep.
And Ronnie would turn around and say, Andy, how do you spell greyhound? Meaning E-Y-R-A-Y. Yeah. And if you didn't answer him in 5 seconds or 2 seconds, he'd say, doesn't matter, I'll put dog. He'd write dog. That's what I learned from Ronnie. He didn't waste time. He just got on with it.
So this is in the realms of criminality. Have you had a crack at trying to decide if Pell is guilty or not? On the charge, the High Court at the minute.
Right, okay. It seems very likely that he's been a party to a lot of very ordinary things. And yet I'll say this. If I were charged or any relative of mine were charged and convicted on evidence so slender from one witness only, I think you'd be unhappy with the system.
Yes, so we've, I think, all said this, and I've been accused on the social media of being a pedophile lover and all that.
No, I'm not a pedophile lover, and I'm not a Pell defender, and I'm quite friendly with the person that's written a very tough book about him, and I get it, and I don't love him, but I just think, you know, if you can go down on the evidence of one person uncorroborated, it's a slippery slope.
Right, you're talking about Louise Milligan?
Is that
Go ahead, Mick.
Thank you, John.
Oh, well, I wasn't sure if that was the question.
No, I just wondered.
Is this about Louise Milligan?
I liked the book and I admired what she did. Do you think she had a vendetta against Pell?
I think when you do books, no, I don't know about vendetta, but when you do a book, you take a stand, don't you? If you write a book about Winks, it's sort of pro-Winks, and then you become the guy that defends her against somebody saying the American horse is better. And there's a bit of that happens. So she has ended up sort of having to defend the stand that was taken. I think she was very fortunate that, you know, the court case turned out the way it did, because that meant the book could get back on the shelves and so on. And God bless her. But it's he clearly is an intelligent man. He's not a fool. He must have turned a blind eye to things that Blind Freddy could see. He must have. I find it hard to believe he didn't. And I think that's why he's being punished.
Yes.
Do you think it's trial by media? Do you think a lot of that nowadays is trial by media? You people, well, the media are looking for a story or an angle each time.
Well, in the end, it's they're tried in a court by a jury.
I understand, but are they influenced?
Not by media, but
are they influenced by media?
I think all of us are influenced by the opinion of others. And I think social media is a...
Do you think it's going on too much, the trial by media or the influence by media? Nowadays,
I'd put it as social media as a very big,
but also mainstream media.
Yeah, probably.
Now, Andrew Rule,
that links up.
This is possibly the final question, unless this sparks another round of investigative inquiries.
Yep.
There's a reason for asking this. Are you regarded with acquaintances overseas who write about crime? Do you ever go over and visit other law enforcement agencies? Because there's a reason I'm asking this. Are you across whether you think Jeffrey Epstein, the recidivist pedophile and disgraceful man in America who is... who's implicated with Bill Clinton and
Prince Andrew.
Yep. Do you think he killed himself? And have you have any contact with people overseas in your vocational profession.
I have no inside knowledge about that whatsoever. It does look interesting that a sort of wealthy, fit man that probably had the best medical attention would die in those circumstances. You'd think it might be self-inflicted. But people do die.
Well, there we are, Mick. We've
how's that for sitting on the fence?
Good way to finish. People do die. Yeah.
Andrew said just before we went on air, he said, "Do we edit this?" Or I said, "No, you got to be careful what you say." Has he been careful about what he said?
Robbie out.
No. Well,
because they'll have stuff. They'll listen. So if you haven't got the catchword, if you haven't got the person's name, it won't their attention.
Well, what we'll do is we'll finish this and then we'll have a discussion about what Andrew's talking about. Andrew Rule, thank you so much for coming in and being part of You Cannot Be Serious. And we go out with, who do we go out with, Mick?
Daddy Cool.
Daddy.
Well, are we going to change this? What do you think?
Streets late at night.
Well,
I'm worried because you ain't treating me right. Come back again. I'm just crazy about you, babe.
You said that.
I spoke to your mama.
We've all been going along to Monica Nightingale and Daddy Cool.
Monica Nightingale.